Welcome back to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. Let's get right into activist news and review all the tree sits that are happening. In California, the Luna tree sit, approaching 23 months in the tree, called Luna is Julia Butterfly. And on Gypsy Mountain, there's a tree sit been going on for a while. That's also going on in California. Nate is up at the Freshwater Tree Sit. He's been there just 13 months. Okay, and there's the Arcata Community Forest Tree Sit. They've been up about a month. In Oregon, the Fall Creek Tree Village, also known as Red Cloud Thunder. They've been up about a year and a half now. The Windberry Tree Village, they've been up about 11 months. Okay, the Eagle Tree Village, and I have more news about Eagle Tree. So they've been up for about 6 months. The Umpqua Tree Sit, also in Washington. Two women are personing this tree sit, River and Madrone. And in Washington, the Watch Mountain Tree Village. I'm not sure if they're still up. And associated with Watch Mountain is the Fossil Creek Tree Sit. There has been a resolution to the logging plans in the Watch Mountain Fossil Creek area. And in the Alajo Valley of British Columbia, the Stoltman Wilderness Tree Sit. They are friends of the Alajo are up in that tree trying to stop logging after a violent attack by 100 Interfor logging company employees. Several people were injured and hospitalized in that one. All right. Well, that's a roundup of the tree sits that Uncle Dennis knows about, and I need an update on that here. That's about a month old. But here it is. Here's the update for Friday, November 12th. For the Eagle Creek road blockade, they have completed 4 months of preventing logging at the Eagle Creek timber sales on the Mount Hood National Forest. In addition, activists have been sitting in the old-growth trees for over 200 days in another area of the same timber sale. Although the Forest Service rules require an end to logging after October 31st and before June 1st, activists have learned that the Mount Hood Forest has issued a waiver to allow year-round cutting. They now feel they cannot leave the road blockade until the Forest Service revokes the waiver and immediately suspends the Eagle timber sales while President Clinton's roadless area policy is being developed. So folks are still up there. I have definite confirmation that the Eagle Road blockade is still going on. If you want more information, contact Ivan at Cascadia Forest Alliance. His number, I don't have the area code, but I believe it's 541-241-4879. 541-241-4879. They didn't actually put it on here, but I'm pretty sure Oregon is 541. Okay, let's move into animal news. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service have proposed listing wild Atlantic salmon as endangered. The announcement formalizes a suggestion made earlier this month by the two agencies after they concluded that Atlantic salmon stocks indigenous to 8 Gulf of Maine rivers, the last known remaining natural reproducing populations in the United States, remain at very low levels and face continuing threats. Although significant efforts have been made to recover the species under the state of Maine's conservation plan, they are not believed to be enough to ensure the survival of the salmon. While Maine's existing conservation plan is vital to recovering the species, it does not adequately address the increasing threats to salmon from aquaculture, fish disease, habitat modification, and catch-and-release fishing, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Jamie Rappaport-Clark. It's time to consider tougher protective measures to ensure survival of the species. We will continue to work closely with the state of Maine industry and the conservation community to protect wild salmon. But Maine Governor Angus King criticized the decision, saying the agencies should give the state efforts more time to show results and questioned the science behind the decision. I'm very disappointed in today's decision, King said in a written statement. It serves neither the salmon nor the people of Maine. The proposed rule would list the Atlantic salmon as endangered, was published in this Wednesday's Federal Register. Agencies will accept written comments on the proposal through February 15th of next year. And Washington governor to investigate the macaw whale hunt. Washington State Governor Gary Locke told whale activists in Port Angeles this last Tuesday he will consider intervening against the killing of gray whales by the macaw Indian tribe. "I've always been against the hunt," Governor Locke said. State lawmakers had said they could not intervene as the hunt concerns a treaty between an Indian tribe and the federal government, but state law gives the government the authority to intervene in federal and tribal fishery matters that could defeat the state's interest in conserving a species classified as protected. The gray whale is listed as a protected species under the rules of Washington State's Department of Fish and Wildlife. The option was brought to the governor's attention by Sea Shepherd Conservation President Paul Watson and Chuck Owens of the Peninsula Citizens for the Protection of Whales. "The governor told us that after talking with us today, he is asking the Secretary of State and the Attorney General to look into the resident whale issue and see what they can do about it," said Owens. "Biologists suspect that the macaw have been hunting protected resident gray whales, not migratory ones. The primary mitigation occurs from mid-December to mid-January, and from late February through the end of April," said Watson. "The macaw have been hunting outside those time frames, and any take at all from the resident herd is clearly a conservation threat. The state of Washington is legally obligated to bar the hunt for that reason." And in Iowa, an estimated 700 gallons of ammonia water solution was dumped over the weekend into a storm sewer that discharges into Lizard Creek in Pocahontas, Iowa. The solution killed thousands of fish. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources investigators responded Sunday evening and collected water samples. They followed the creek upstream to a storm sewer outfall. "There was an ammonia odor in the storm tile," said Ken Hessenus. Environmental specialist with DNR Spencer's office. Investigators then went to the pro-cooperative site just upstream of the storm drain and learned the co-op had a leaking anhydrous ammonia tank on Friday. Pro-cooperative had to repair a leaking valve on an anhydrous ammonia tank, so they bled a 2-inch line into a nurse tank that held about 700 gallons of water in it, said Hessenius. An unknown person was reported to have emptied the water tank over the weekend. Stream levels are very low right now, so the ammonia water had a significant impact on the stream, causing a fish kill, said Hessenius. An estimated half mile of Lizard Creek was affected. Fish kill numbers will be available later on, but preliminary estimates are thousands of fish. There are diluting waters coming into the stream, including the Pocahontas wastewater treatment discharge. out of the frying pan and into the fire for those fish. And from Tucson, Arizona, the Center for Biological Diversity plans to sue the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation over the agency's failure to protect the endangered southwestern willow flycatcher and the riverside habitat at the Virgin River Delta in Lake Mead in southern Nevada. On Tuesday, the group sent the Bureau a 60-day notice of intent to sue. A successful lawsuit could limit water storage behind Hoover Dam pending completion of an environmental impact analysis and provide substantial habitat protection for the birds. Consultation between the two agencies in 1996 and 97 allowed the reclamation to harm flycatchers at the Colorado River Delta at Lake Mead, but did not consider Virgin River flycatchers and prohibited any additional loss of flycatchers in the lower Colorado River. Flycatchers were discovered at the Virgin River Delta after conclusion of the consultation. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the southwestern willow flycatcher is near extinction. The agency characterized the loss of Lake Mead, Colorado River Delta flycatchers in 1997 and 98 as catastrophic. Today, only five major flycatcher populations, those supporting more than 25 pairs, remain in Arizona, California, and New Mexico, and a total of fewer than 500 flycatcher pairs remain throughout the range of that species. And in last Tuesday's election, Washington state voters sunk a ballot initiative that would have banned certain types of fishing nets in state waters in order to recover salmon populations off the coast. Supporters reported that the ban would have preserved much of the ocean floor, protected endangered and threatened fish populations, and saved taxpayers money in environmental recovery programs. According to an Associated Press article, Roughly 40% of Washington voters supported the ban, with about 60% voting against. Initiative 696 was the second attempt in 4 years to prohibit certain types of fishing gear from state waters. The proposal would have banned most commercial fishing nets from state waters, including Puget Sound and waters up to 3 miles off the Washington coast. And in a special session of the Alaskan State Legislature on September 25th, Alaska lawmakers voted 40-20 to allow increased aerial hunting of wolves. With the vote, the legislature overrode the governor's veto and overturned a citizen's ballot initiative in 1996. 58% of Alaskan voters approved a statewide ballot that effectively banned same-day airborne wolf hunting. The bill approved by the legislature amends current law by authorizing the state to use airplanes to hunt wolves in non-emergency situations. And a federal district judge in California ruled in February that leghold traps can be used to protect federally listed species. In 1998, California voters approved a ban on leghold traps. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, along with several environmental groups, opposed the ban on grounds that the traps were necessary to protect endangered species. The National Audubon Society and other groups sued to overturn the ban, and in February the court issued an order finding the ban didn't apply to federal employees using traps to protect species under the Federal Endangered Species Initiative. All right, let's move into international news here. From Port Morrisey, Australia, timber produced sustainably by forest communities in Papua New Guinea has hit the Australian market. At a launch in Sydney yesterday, representatives from the Worldwide Fund for Nature called on Australian timber consumers to buy Papua New Guinea eco-timber as an alternative to rainforest timber from industrial logging operations. The World Wildlife Fund Papua New Guinea Country Coordinator Kilyali Khalit said PNG Eco Timber is the first to reach the Australian market bearing the Forest Stewardship Council stamp of approval. The FSC is an internationally recognized system of certifying timber that takes into account the economic, environmental, and social importance of forests. The Forest Stewardship Council system establishes forest management performance standards that are independently audited, giving consumers the confidence that the timber they are buying is good wood. The PNG Eco Timber, now available in Australia, comes from a community-run project in West New Britain under the Papua New Guinea National Government Program funded by the European Union. Trained community members produce timber using a portable sawmill set up within the forest. To meet the strict criteria of the Forest Stewardship Council, the area to be logged is divided into a number of clearly marked areas of 5 to 20 hectares each. That's about 10 to 40 acres. Before logging takes place, a full inventory of the area is undertaken. Cutting of small trees and seed trees is not allowed, and trees to be logged are carefully selected so that when they fall, they do not damage nearby seedlings or create large gaps in the canopy. Industrial-scale logging has been ravaging Papua New Guinea for the past 2 decades, and the World Wildlife Fund says that large-scale industrial logging has caused unacceptable damage and that community forestry is the far superior alternative. News from Congress is that some environmental writers may yet slip through, but most of those controversial writers have been dropped. But Senator Slade Gordon of Washington was disappointed he had to drop language provisions known as riders that he would have helped rural areas. "It's total frustration on our part," said Cynthia Bergman, spokeswoman for the Washington State Republican, but Gordon didn't come away empty. The $14.8 billion Interior Appropriations Bill includes $57 million for projects in his home state, including a near doubling of the funds for the removal of the Elwha Dam on the Olympic Peninsula. And so I believe that they're very close to wrapping up this bill. I believe it passed the Senate, so onto the House, something like that. Anyway, it's half the appropriations bill is halfway through now, but most of the writers are gone. And environmentalists are entitled to representation on committees advising federal officials about how to negotiate trade agreements governing wood and paper products, a judge ruled recently. U.S. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky must name at least one environmentalist to each of two panels that advise her on wood and paper product negotiations, a U.S. District Judge Barbara Rothstein decided. Limiting membership on the advisory committees to timber and paper industry officials violated the Federal Advisory Council Act, which requires the advisory panels represent a fair balance of viewpoints, Rothstein ruled. Rothstein directed Barshefsky to expedite the appointment of at least one environmentalist to the 15-member Committee on Wood Products and one environmentalist on a 10-person Paper Products Committee. The committees in question, among more than two dozen that advise the government on international trade, have pushed for elimination on tariffs of wood and paper products. Environmentalists said the move would increase worldwide consumption of paper and wood products, leading to more logging. And Irvine, California-based Homebase, the sixth largest home improvement retailer in the United States, announced today that the company plans to stop selling wood from endangered old-growth forests. Rainforest Action Network has kept unrelenting pressure on Homebase and the other top 10 do-it-yourself chains to stop selling old-growth wood since Home Depot's August 26th announcement that the retail behemoth would phase out all wood products derived from old-growth forests. It's no longer a question of whether home improvement stores will stop selling old-growth wood, but when they will stop, asserted RAN Old Growth Campaign Director Michael Brune. And from where we stand, I wonder why it's taken them so long, and I wonder what it has what has to transpire for stores sitting on the fence to follow suit. All right. And the National Park Service is proposing to make permanent prohibition on the park's use of snowmobiles in the core of Denali National Park in Alaska. That includes Mount McKinley. The controversial proposal, first raised as a temporary ban last February, has prompted lawsuits by both environmentalists and snowmobilers. Snowmobiles have been prohibited from about a third of Denali National Park and Preserve since February when a 12-month temporary prohibition was issued. A new temporary closure is proposed to cover the spring of 2000 while permanent regulation proposals are being considered. Keeping this portion of Denali closed to snowmobiles would prevent detriment to the inherent resource values, including wildlife and wilderness, and would provide opportunities for solitude and non-motorized winter activities, said National Park Service Alaska Regional Director Bob Barbie. The proposal is consistent with the park's longstanding management of this area. Use of snowmobiles in the park was illegal prior to December 1980 when the park was expanded by the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. The legislation allowed snowmobile use for traditional activities, but that phrase was not defined in law or regulation. Various bans on snowmobile use in the core of the park were therefore found to be unenforceable. Based on the proposed definition of traditional activities, which is derived from the legislative history of the underlying 1980 Alaska Lands Act, snowmobile use would now be prohibited in the roughly 2 million acres of pre-1980 parkland. The proposed regulation defines the traditional activity as one that generally and lawfully occurred in a unit or a geographically defined area of a unit prior to enactment of the ANILCA, and that was typically associated with that region as an integral and established part of a utilitarian Alaskan lifestyle or cultural pattern. But snowmobile use for traditional activities would be unaffected by the proposal in the 4 million acres of park and preserve added after 1980, including popular riding areas closest to the Petersville Road on the south side of the Alaskan Range. The proposal would close two small drainage areas south of Cantwell, which were left open in February of 1990, temporary regulation. The National Park Service says snowmobiles have rarely been used in the original portions of Denali, which would now be permanently closed to such use. And the Nature Conservancy has announced a $68 million plan to preserve tall and short grassland prairies in the U.S. Great Plains. More than half of those funds have already been raised, and the Great Plains plan will focus national attention on threats to the remaining grasslands, said Nature Conservancy President John Sawhill, announcing the plan in Kansas City, Missouri. All too often, the focus of natural environmental discussion has been on high-profile disputes like those over old-growth forests and the rivers of the Pacific Northwest, said Sawhill, pointing out that the growing population of the Great Plains region poses equal threats to prairie areas. There is more urgency to save these last remnants than 10 years ago, Sawhill continues. If we don't protect them today, they're just not going to be there. And you can help save Some areas in Maine. The west coast of Penobscot Bay is thickly forested and rimmed with coastal mountains. There is a strong and well-established ecotourism-based economy in the area, from lobster fisheries and kayak and windjammer tours to hiking, camping, bed and breakfast-style hostels, and numerous other sustainably recreationally-based enjoyment of the outstanding scenic vistas of the area. And the annual migration of tourists empowers a highly decentralized, very robust economy. And the MBNA's sprawl on Duck Trap Mountain and its efforts to urbanize the towns at either end of the Penobscot Central Mountain Range threatens to severely damage the area's environment and do away with this very well-established tourism-based economy in place in Maine. The urban sprawl plans of the credit peddlers is a nightmare vision of a coast where dozens of identical telephone sales sweatshops, each with 800 to 1,000 headset-clad sales-pitching keyboard pounders, dominate the economy, the politics, and the social matrix of the coastal towns here. The Sierra Club and other conservation-oriented groups should have nothing to do with MBNA, a company that is purposely transforming Maine coastal forests and farmland into mile after mile of office building complexes. As is well known, such development typically induces the building of chain stores, subdivisions, and housing sprawling out in association with office park developments. For those of you who wonder what's going on here, MBNA issues credit cards. What to do? Well, write to the Sierra Club. Tell them to drop their MBNA affinity card immediately. Here's some addresses. Sierra Club, Maine Chapter, 192 State Street, Portland, Maine, 04101. Sierra Club, Maine Chapter, 192 State Street, Portland, Maine, 04101. Or the Sierra Club National Office, 85 2nd Street, 2nd Floor, San Francisco, California, 94105. That's Sierra Club National Office, 85 2nd Street, 2nd Floor, San Francisco, California, 94105. Let them know to drop the credit card, okay? Save Maine. And down in Texas, secrecy for corporate offenders enforced by a gag on public employees. From Austin, Texas, more than 240 Texas companies have obtained immunity from prosecution for more than 1,000 environmental violations under the Environmental Audit Privilege Law, championed by Governor George W. Bush, who's running for president. And this is according to documents released by the Texas Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Texas state environmental employees are forbidden from disclosing secret corporate audit results, even when the violations have public health implications. Since 1995, of the audit privilege law, one of the earliest environmental initiatives of Governor Bush, 242 companies have filed 1,040 privileged internal audits with the Texas Natural Resources Conservation Commission. Texas corporations average more than 4 environmental violations for each privilege filing. Under the Texas law, corporations are protected from prosecution for violations they self-report. But another hallmark of the Texas audit immunity law is secrecy. Filings are treated as confidential by the Texas Natural Resources Conservation Commission and may not be released to the public. Supporters of the law claim the secrecy is needed to minimize the potential for adverse community reaction. In other words, people might get pissed if they knew what was going on. Oh, boy. And two attacks were mounted against a successful cyanide mining ban in Montana. First, owners of a proposed gold mine in the state announced plans to sue the state for $600 million in lost profits as a result of a 1998 ballot initiative banning cyanide mining. The announcement came days after the state legislature considered bills to modify the initiative. The state legislature then passed Senate Bill 345, which gives counties the ability to ban cyanide mining, effectively nullifying that ballot measure. All right. Well, that's about all the time I've got for news tonight. If you want to get your news announcements or comments from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F @cruzio.com, or send your letters, donations, CDs, or cassettes to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And Uncle Dennis encourages you to please send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. And nothing that pisses me off more than reading an announcement about an event that already happened. And for more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, subscribe to the Earth First Journal there at P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon 97440. And Earth First Radio is broadcast live on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM here in Santa Cruz every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Or you can listen to Earth First Radio anytime on your computer on the World Wide Web at radioforall.web.net. That's radio for all, the number four, radioforall.web.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need is free for downloading at the website. Earth First Radio is being rebroadcast on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. If you found us on the web, ask your local station to download and rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. Earth First Radio is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening, and please tune in again. And we're going to go out here with a little music. This one is from Daryl Cherney's Timber cassette, and this one is called Earth Night Action.
Now, Earth Day 1990 was Dennis Hayes' vision, but they're keeping us together. It only caused division. He said, turn down your thermostat and recycle toilet paper. And as long as they contribute, don't confront the corporate rapers. Now there were these griping dissidents holed up in Santa Cruz. They were pondering this problem, smoking joints and drinking booze. They said Earth Day has sold out again, they could not get caught. So we've come up with a concept, one we know that can't be bought. We'll have an Earth Night Action. Yeah, it's a splinter faction. We're gonna take down power lines tonight. We'll have an Earth Night Action. It's an Earth Day reaction. Yeah, Santa Cruz ain't gonna have no lights. Now some folks said, hey, Santa Cruz just had a big earthquake, and a topple in their power lines was a tactical mistake. But big mountains feeding them their coal, Prince William found their oil. Hey, I'm sorry if their fridge went dead and their TV dinner spoiled. We'll have an Earth Night Action. It's instant satisfaction. We're gonna take down power lines tonight. We'll have an Earth Night Action. It's an Earth Day reaction. Yes, Santa Cruz ain't gonna have no lights. In San Luis Obispo, they've got Diablo Nuke, but the best that they could fight it with were some songs that made me puke. PG&E has gotta go, but it seems so damn complex. But Earth Night has the answer. Diablo Canyon's best! Damn! We'll have an Earth Night Action. It's a felony infraction. We're gonna take down power lines tonight. We'll have an Earth Night Action. It's an Earth Day reaction. Yes, Santa Cruz ain't gonna have no lights. San Luis Obispo ain't gonna have no lights. L.A. ain't gonna have no lights.
Oh, my God.
Houston ain't gonna have no lights. New York ain't gonna have no lights. Gay Perry ain't gonna have no lights. Moscow ain't gonna have no lights.
Hey, hey, hey.
Tokyo ain't gonna have no lights.